Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Miles. If you are a returning listener or subscriber, welcome back. So glad to have you here again. I missed you guys on Saturday this much. Watched a little bit of the show. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Big Pascal and Toussaint did a great job filling in while I was gone. Never worry when those guys are filling in. Also, if you're new to the channel, welcome. Glad to have you here. If you do like what you're seeing, please like and subscribe on the way out. It's a passive gesture that goes a long way. Really appreciate it here. Also, wherever you are watching or listening to this show, there should be links in the description to drumroll. I think there was a drumroll sound effect that I got rid of for one of these mean ones. For the live show in D.C., June 8th, Beyond the Black Jacobins, C.L.R. James and the Struggle for Socialism in America, featuring such esteemed names as Adolf Reed, the man of the Mau Mau Hour, Pascal Robert, will be there, Daniel Tutt, Derek Varn, as Toussaint calls him, my stunt double Billy Bunton, Vanessa Willis, and me, Jason Miles. We will be there. And if you can't make it for whatever reason, that's fine. That link in the description will also lead you to where you can get tickets to the live stream, Bus Boys and Poets, June 8th, Washington, D.C. I haven't been to D.C. Oof. What year is it? 2024? Like 5 years. At least 5 years. Maybe longer. So I'm excited to go back to D.C. Looking forward to seeing some familiar faces. I'm sure some of the people that came out to some of those East Coast shows are going to come out, so I'm excited for that. But enough plugging of stuff. Topic at hand, the topic that you guys are here for, the politics of work. There is a notion I see play out here in Mexico, as well as the U.S., that we have become valuable humans based on the amount of work we do and the types of work we do as well. What can we learn from two dead white guys about our relations to work and the way in which we see and understand the world? From the book Double Shift, Spinoza and Marx on the Politics of Work. Work is made possible by subordination to nature, just as history is realized through conflict and passion. What both forms of action have in common is their cunning and teleology, their tendency to arrive at their ends by a negation of their mastery. Labor is the model for action, including reason's action in the world. Of course, this cuts both ways. The more labor is used to define the concept, the more the concept or thinking defines labor. As Marx argued, the more Hegel makes labor the model for thought, the more it appears that labor itself is conceived of abstractly. The only labor which Hegel knows and recognizes is abstract mental labor. Externalization and realization is a mental process. A process of thought. Actually existing labor is determined by social relations that exceed and undermine this logic. That is a quote from Double Shift, Spinoza and Marx on the Politics of Work, written by our guest, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Southern Maine. Please welcome Jason Reed. How are you, Jason?
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. Interesting book you have here. A couple days ago, I was talking to another philosopher that you may know, philosophy professor you may know, Ben Burgess.
Not sure, but go ahead.
He's also in this podcast world as well. And I was telling him about this. He goes, oh, wow, that sounds really interesting. He goes, you know, Jason Reed, goes, I tried to get that guy on my show and he just ignored me. So take that, Ben Burgess. No, I'm sure you just didn't see the email. But I know you get this question a lot, and I feel I wouldn't be right without asking, why Spinoza and Marx? I understand Marx, but what do you think he misses that Spinoza gets right about our relationship with labor?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that for me, it's can be summed up by the problem that Spinoza poses in his book, The Theological Political Treatise, where he says, you know, the fundamental mystery is why people fight for servitude as if it was salvation. And in some sense, this can be understood as Spinoza's variation on a kind of ideological problem. You know, why do people subject themselves? But there's the very formulation of it suggests something a little different than what you conventionally find in, say, Marx or in other theories of ideology. And it's this very active component, right? People are actively not just enduring their servitude or enduring their indoctrination or enduring their domination, but they're in some sense actively striving for it. And to me, that formulation seems very relevant for thinking about work, because so much of our contemporary culture around work is this sort of attempt to overcome the precarity, the exploitation, all of the negative components of work by supposedly, you know, working harder, by this idea of a sort of grind set mentality or a hustle mentality, or more specifically in terms of, you know, taking on extra types of labor, whether it be through apps like Uber and the like, or whether it be through developing some kind of side gig. This idea that people are constantly dealing with the vulnerability and exploitation of work by doubling down on work itself. And that aspect seemed to me to demand a sort of theory of striving, of desire, that Spinoza offered that wasn't necessarily there to be found in Marx.
Really? So you think Spinoza is more relevant in the current context than maybe Marx is?
I wouldn't say more relevant, because I do think that, I mean, I'm trying to sort of think the two together, because I do think that, for me at least, the general formula for thinking about work very much comes from Marx. I mean, I think on one level, you know, if you really wanted to simplify things a little bit, I would say that a lot of Marx's analysis of capital stems from the unique characteristics of work or of labor power as a commodity. That one of the two things that make it very unique are, one, unlike any other commodity, when I sell my labor power to the boss or the company or whatever, I'm stuck with it. I can't separate myself from it. It's not like selling something to someone where I can just leave and say, okay, that's yours now, go ahead, take care of it. When I sell my labor power, I am the living embodiment of that labor power, so I have to endure it. And so in some sense, it's because I cannot alienate it in the legal economic sense of the term, that I'm alienated in the more existential sense of the term, because I'm stuck living a life that's not mine, living time that is not mine. That's the first thing that Marx gives us to think about in terms of labor. And then the second thing is that labor power is also unique as a commodity, in that its productivity, or what it is capable of doing, is not entirely fixed. You know, if I buy a pound of flour, that's it. I have a pound of flour. But when you buy an hour of labor power, when you sell an hour of labor power, it is then up to the capitalist, the boss, to make that labor power as productive as possible. And of course, you know, for Marx, the whole kernel of capitalism as an economic system is really dependent upon the fundamental difference between how much labor power costs, the wages, and how much it produces. So those two characteristics, I think, are fundamental to my thinking about work. Yet I also want to tie into them this sort of Spinozist idea that, You know, one of the things that Spinoza really underscores is that everyone, well, really for Spinoza, everything is striving to maintain itself in whatever way it knows how. And I think that the whatever way it knows how is an important point, because our striving is in some sense determined or shaped by what we imagine or understand to be possible. And so to go back to what I said earlier, striving to sort of work harder to overcome the limitations and difficulties of work is really predicated on a foreclosure of the imagination of other possibilities, like possibilities of collective struggle, possibilities of transforming the conditions of work itself. If those are foreclosed for us, then what we're going to do is strive in the only way that we can imagine, and that is to strive to work harder to improve the conditions of work.
We have a question here from Connor. Thank you, Connor. It seems as though for Spinoza, work changes the worker themselves, but does it change the world? Sorry if this sounds like a naive question.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, on the one hand, I think that Spinoza doesn't have a very developed theory of work, but at the same time, given that Spinoza is very, you know, for him, and this is a strong point of commonality between Spinoza and Marx, they both think that human beings are not, to use Spinoza's terms, kingdom within a kingdom. We're not this separate and distinct thing that stands above the rest of nature, the rest of society. We are part of the world. We are shaped and determined by the world, and our capacity to act on the world is in some sense determined and shaped as well, that we operate, to use the word that resonates with the Latin that Spinoza uses, and to operate means to always act on the world in ways that have been shaped and determined by the limitations, say, of our bodies, by the limitations of the materials around us. So we are constantly acting within the conditions that are given. So there's a way in which Spinoza's philosophy very much carries in this very kind of work type mentality, that it is the sense that we're always acting in and through the conditions that are given to us.
You had an interesting quote by Spinoza where he talks about the soldier and horses. I don't have my copy in front of me where I highlighted that quote that I think kind of expands on, you know, also what you're saying about the relationship between work and then the way we see the world. You probably can explain this.
Yeah, Spinoza says, and he uses this as a key sort of example to talk about the limitations of the knowledge that we start with in trying to make sense of the world. And he says that if a soldier sees a hoof print in the sand, he will think of war, whereas if a farmer sees a hoof print in the sand, he will think of plowing or of harvesting, right? And I think there are two important things about this. One is, of course, we don't really, I mean, on both cases, we're dealing with a kind of inadequate or partial or limited knowledge. Like neither the soldier nor the farmer knows why the hoof print is really there, why the horse was there. They both could be wrong. But at the same time, what both the soldier and the farmer think is in some sense causally determined and understandable, right? We understand, if we know that the soldier is a soldier, we understand the associations and connections that connect hoofprints to war. In the same way, if we know that the farmer is a farmer, we know the associations and connections that connect it to planting or harvesting. And there is this, for Spinoza, there's this, you know, he makes a distinction between what he calls adequate ideas and inadequate ideas. Adequate ideas are the ideas that comprehend and understand their causes, because to understand things for Spinoza, and this is also what makes him very amenable to a kind of materialist understanding, to understand something is to understand its causes, to understand how it came to be in the world and what it is, how it's affecting the world. But inadequate ideas are ideas that do not comprehend their causes, like a hoof print in the sand. We don't know why it came from there, where it came from, but there still is a necessity, right? And I think one of the things that Spinoza offers in terms of thinking about ideology is that, you know, even when people have, for example, grossly misinformed or even fantastic ideas about what's going on in the world, with, you know, conspiracy theories and the like, there are causal connections which help us to understand why people make the connections they do, right? That for example, just take a quick and sort of complicated example, the sort of right wing kind of, you know, immigrants are stealing our jobs is an inadequate idea, but it is in some sense an actual expression of really existing economic uncertainty, feelings of powerlessness, etc. It is like a hoofprint in the sand, and that there is something real there, even if the associations that are created around it are entirely fictitious.
Shifting gears a bit, the thing that really interests me about your book is that you reference some movies and pop culture, something we do talk about on this show quite a bit. In your book, you reference Better Call Saul, Breaking Bad, Office Space, and Fight Club. Why did you choose to go that route for such a philosophical kind of academic book? And don't some of these shows in the end put a value to work? For example, Office Space ends with the main character becoming a construction worker. Mm-hmm. Breaking Bad, which I didn't watch, I only saw one episode, but I know that the guy that wrote it so the main character becomes the villain. And I don't know if people really look at him as a villain. And then, you know, why not The Office? What you got against Steve Carell?
So take a couple of those, because that's a lot in that question. But for me, part of the reason why I wanted to write about or include popular culture, one is because I do think that popular culture is a way that people make sense of the world, and it even though, I mean, in some sense, the relationship between popular culture and work is a very paradoxical one, because, you know, usually people watch things like TV and movies as an escape from their day-to-day work lives. And there's a way in which, you know, a lot of television and movies doesn't want to deal with work at all. You get the sort of classic, you know, the sort of sitcom scenario where if it's set in an office place, people rarely ever actually have to do work. They just sort of hang out and chit chat and make jokes. Or if it is about work, it's about some highly sort of like romanticized version of like being a surgeon or a lawyer or a cop, where it's all very, you know, it's all very glamorous. And so there's a way in which popular culture doesn't deal with work by and large, but when popular culture does deal with work, I think some of it can be very interesting. And for reasons that I still don't really understand. I mean, to go to the first example, Fight Club and Office Space, there was just a slew of movies that came out in 1999, which dealt with the office and the cubicle specifically. It was the year that the cubicle came under heavy sort of pop culture scrutiny in various types of movies, ranging from the somewhat obscure, I mean, Office Space didn't really develop an audience until it was repeated again and again on television, Comedy Central, and so on, to movies that, you know, were nominated for Academy Awards, like American Beauty, to even movies like, people forget how much The Matrix begins with a guy just wanting to escape his life in a cubicle. He just wants something more than being a cubicle slave. So, and I don't entirely, I mean, it was a very interesting moment. But as you said, one of the interesting things about that moment is that a lot of the criticisms of work that you get in some of these movies, like Office Space, which I believe had its tagline, "Work sucks," is a very limited and truncated criticism of work. I mean, at the end of Office Space, which deals with a worker in a tech company, primarily dealing with the issues of the quote unquote millennium bug, right? The idea that, you know, all this software that had 99 as the year was going to cause problems when the decade, the century, millennium ended. And it meant all this, you know, coding and debugging. But he's working in a tech company, and he's constantly dealing with the fact that because it is a tech company, because it's a form of white collar work, that his attentiveness or his ability to deal with, like, just showing a certain kind of conviction and showing a certain kind of dedication is more important than the work itself, right? And when he escapes that work at the end of the movie, he ends up, as you said, working in construction. And there's like this line at the end of the movie where he says, you know, this isn't so bad. I'm getting fresh air. I'm getting exercise, and hanging out with my friends. And it, to me, it underscores the way in which a lot of criticisms of work are limited in the sense that they pit one kind of work against another kind of work. Like, one sort of work becomes almost synonymous with everything that is wrong with work. In this case, the cubicle, the white collar job with this sort of meaninglessness and its, you know, over reliance on hierarchy and rituals of hierarchy than actually doing anything real becomes the target. And this is true not just of Office Space, but this is also true of the more radical, to some extent, film Fight Club, other films from that period, where they really focus on everything is wrong with work can be summed up by the cubicle. And then they often bring up another kind of work that ends up really being the supposed good form of work. Like construction work in Office Space, but even in a movie like Fight Club, there still is, you know, which has much more of this idea of, you know, destroying credit rating companies and overcoming society. It still has this notion of, like, the character of Tyler Durden, right? Brad Pitt's character is kind of, he makes soap. He does real things. He really makes something in the world. He doesn't just apply a formula, which is what the Edward Norton character sees himself as doing.
So what was the through line actually for those two movies? Because when I saw the comparison, because they're in the same chapter, I think that's chapter two or three, where you start talking about the movies and you talk about these two. And I think you even say in the book, like, the only thing that most people would find in common is that they both came out in 1999. And I was sitting there trying to think about what both movies had in common, as I'm not the biggest Fight Club fan, right, but I've seen Office Space. And, you know, unlike you, I'm actually a fan of The Office. But I don't know what you have against Jim and Pam, man. I don't know if, you know, Ryan the Temp pissed you off. But and to me, Office Space, the movie, and The Office are pretty, you know, synonymous.
Right.
But I did and still do laugh hysterically every time I see Office Space. But I also understand, as someone that is 46 and did work in a traditional office where there was cubicles and not open spaces and your boss wasn't your friend. And, you know, you made a comment in the book where you actually say these are antiquated views of work. And I think you said like in a couple years, you know, the relations that you even see in these movies will be gone because of kind of the main, not main, but one of the big plots in Office Space. You know, the main character, Ron Livingston's character, is trying to avoid his boss because he doesn't want to work on a Saturday.
Right.
And what's funny is I did some contract work in the tech world. Working weekends is mandatory. 24 hours on call is kind of the mode of the millennial and maybe even Gen Z. The way they look at work, especially if you're in an office. Whether you're in a cubicle or a tech company with nap pods and micro kitchens on every floor.
Mm-hmm.
But at Fight Club, I don't know. For me, it didn't really address that as much. What did you see the through line with Fight Club and an Office Space? Besides just the they both were in offices in the beginning.
Well, I mean, I think they both have this ambivalent relationship to work where they're both highly critical, but they want work to be both meaningful and something one can choose, right? You know, okay. Fight Club has this one scene where the Tyler Durden, Brad Pitt's character, and Edward Norton, Tyler Durden takes Brad Pitt's character to a convenience store, and he pulls out a gun and brings the guy working, the cashier at the convenience store, into the back with the gun,
mm-hmm.
and has him and is rifling through his wallet and sees that the guy has a community college ID, right? He says to him, community college, you know, what is it you were going to study? What is it you wanted to become? And the guy says, I want to become a veterinarian. And he says, why aren't you doing that? And the guy says, well, it's a lot of classes, too much. And Brad Pitt's character says to him, I'm going to, you know, I'm taking your driver's license, so I know where you live. I'm going to come and find you in some period, I don't know, a couple months or something. And if you're not on your way to becoming a veterinarian, I'm going to, you know, kill you or whatever, threatens him in some way. And it's a strange kind of, you know, moment in this film, which otherwise presents itself as a totalizing critique of society, right? Because there's all these references to almost like a post-apocalyptic, like we're going to destroy the world. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, the world I imagine, you're hunting deer, you know, in the Lincoln Center or whatever, in the ruins of Lincoln Center, right? You're gonna, this idea of apocalyptic rebirth. But in the midst of this movie, which gestures towards the idea we got to blow it all up and start all over again, there's this moment where he says to this person, you know, like you should be pursuing your dream job, right? And there's a similar moment in Office Space as well, where there's the lingering question in Office Space that's posed around work is, you know, if you had $1 million, what would mm-hmm. you do? And so there is a sense that both movies are very critical of work, but their criticism is in some sense not framed towards the idea of wanting to entirely dispense with the world of work, but the idea that work should be both meaningful, it should do something, produce something that's useful to someone, not just adding code, or in the case of Fight Club, you know, performing this rather, you know, Edward Norton's character is like a recall supervisor, and all he really does is calculate whether or not it's the loss is, you know, it's more expensive to let the faulty product, you know, be out in the world and deal with the lawsuits or whatever the case may be, or is it more expensive to recall the product, right? It's this cost benefit calculation that is, you know, framed by a sort of cruel indifference towards life and well-being of people. So there is a sense in which in both films, the critique of work is predicated around this idea that work should be meaningful, and it should be meaningful both socially, like do something for the world, and be something that is the person themselves who's doing it can identify with and find meaning in it.
You do bring up that also very funny scene where the Michael Bolton character, when they, because they're kind of asking the question, like, remember when your guidance counselor asked you if you had $1 million, what would you do? And you're supposed to, if you ask a person what they would do if they had $1 million, oh, I would love to fix up cars. You should be a mechanic, right? That's right. The thing. You do what you love. You never work a day in your life, which is, I've always hated that.
Yeah.
And the Michael Bolton character is like, well, that's a bunch of BS, because, you know, if that was the case, no one would ever be a janitor, because who the hell wants to take out trash and clean toilets? Again, I thought that was, I'm glad you brought that up in the book as well. We do have a super chat aimed at you, Dr. Professor Reed, from David Epps. Thank you, David, for the super chat. To better communicate their present conditions, will subjects have to unify their practical engagement with the world so the hoofprint can gain mutual intelligibility for those with common practice?
So, yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, the other thing to sort of tie it back to sort of thinking about Spinoza and Spinoza's relationship to thinking about work is that, as we talked about with the hoofprint example, on the one hand, Spinoza uses work as a way to explain the way in which people have very different ways of making sense of their experience, right? Hoofprint. And, you know, we can think about the way in which that is also true. You know, people, work does take up a lot of our time, a lot of our lives. And it does shape the way we make sense of the world, even when we're off the clock. And part of that making sense is, as sort of implied in the question, is the way in which we make sense of the world in radically different ways, because depending on our position within the division of labor and the work we have to do. But at the same time, Spinoza also says, you know, one of the things that Spinoza wrestles with is this question of, like, you know, Spinoza begins with this idea that, you know, when we come into the world, we are born ignorant of the causes of things and conscious of our desires. Right? We don't know how the world works, but we are very aware that we have desires, we're hungry, thirsty, and so on. And part of the problem with that is that we then tend to interpret the world from our own desires, which is in some sense a warping of how the world works, because if something works for us, we call it good, and if something doesn't work for us, we call it bad. And that those terms, good and bad, don't really tell us anything about the world itself. So, you know, Spinoza at one point is very critical of these terms of evaluation. But he then later says, well, we still need to use these, but we need to recognize that they only make sense within a particular kind of horizon of practical activity, right? Like, so if he says, if you come upon someone and they're building something, and you know what they're trying to build is a house, and you look at it and it doesn't look like it's going to function as a house, you can say then, that's a bad house you're building. It's not going to work. It's, you know, it's not structurally sound. But you need to know what it is that someone is trying to do in order to use these terms of evaluation. So there's a way in which for Spinoza, work both creates the divergences in the sense of we all interpret the world very differently depending on our own place within the world of work, but they also create the basis for a kind of commonality in that if we begin to think about what are our common projects we're trying to do, we can begin to have a meaningful understanding of what it means to call something good or bad.
Well, David, I hope that answers your question. But moving on to more questions, I would love to just sit here and, you know, pick your brain about Vice Club and Office Space and The Office. Please tell me you've seen The Office.
I've seen The Office. I've seen it quite a few times. Yes.
All of it. Do you go back and watch it sometimes when you don't know what you're going to do before you go to sleep?
I have not in a while, but I have.
Yeah. So are you like most Americans and you've seen all 8 seasons multiple times?
Yes, probably some more than others. I mean, it's an interesting question. Why not include that? And I guess it never really, you know, and I guess part of the question is how much is work important to the office? I mean, I think to some extent, you know, to me, it's real contribution to thinking about a critical perspective on work is it really reveals how the idea of a boss who thinks of himself as everyone's friend mm-hmm. is an absolute nightmare. And
how he keeps that job.
Yes. And that and in some sense, you know, going back to what you're saying earlier, and as you point out, that there is a way in which, you know, the cubicle moment was sort of on the decline at the exact moment it was sort of taking precedence in all these films. Mm. But one of the interesting things about Office Space, you know, I think the scene that most people remember from that film is the flare scene. Right.
I'm glad you mentioned that in the book too.
Yeah, that Jennifer Aniston is kind of a side part. She plays a server at this sort of restaurant called Tchotchke's, which is sort of modeled after TGI Fridays or other like fast casual, whatever you want to call it, restaurant. And there's this scene where she's chastised by her boss for not wearing enough flair, and flair are like, you know, little wacky buttons and pins on her apron and uniform. And the strange thing about that scene, of course, is that she is wearing the bare minimum, like, I don't know, 16 pieces or whatever it is. And, you know, the boss says to her, you know, what do you think of anyone who does the bare minimum? And this, you know, the paradoxical imperative there is that you should want to do more. And I think the reason that scene resonates, even as cubicles go away, is this idea, like, you should want to do more, is a lot of the way in which contemporary work is structured, in the sense that you should, you know, even though we're not going to require you to come in on the weekend, you should want to come in on the weekend. You know, it's this classic thing you hear about a lot, especially like Silicon Valley or other jobs where people are told, like, oh, you get this much vacation time a year. And the classic response is, or the classic follow-up to that is, oh, but we never take it because we're so engaged here, right? And I think that, you know, does sort of tangentially connect to The Office as well, in the sense that, like, work should be the end all and be all, not just of your economic existence, but your social existence as well. You should want to be here. Mm-hmm.
Your personality should shine through in your flair.
Exactly.
And it points to the coworker that's just a wacky crack up, and he's got all the flair. Right. He's got 32 pieces of flair. Wouldn't make the minimum 32. Make the minimum 32.
Exactly.
I love that scene. And you also talk about this part before we move on, because there's another movie that I really like that you talked about. I'm so glad you mentioned it, Compliance. But you know, another big focus of Office Space is the consultants, mm-hmm. the efficiency consultants that right. come in, which is actually very contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
And as you put it, people have to re-interview for the job.
Mm-hmm.
And I did like the way you talk about how when we go to a job interview, we're going to overdress for the interview to a certain extent. We're going to admit that we're willing to do more than what's needed. As Michael Scott always says, my weaknesses are my strengths. Mm-hmm. We're going to do a Michael Scott on the interview. Jennifer Aniston's position in a service industry job is definitely a little different than the office workers, and her attitude definitely is a little, because they don't have to deal with customers, so to speak.
Right.
But I would like you to elaborate a little bit on that idea of like consultants coming in and people having to re-interview for their mm-hmm. own job that they do, and prove to these consultants
right.
that they are worthy to stay.
Yeah. Well, I think, as you say, you know, job interviews are always kind of a performance, right? You have to perform. You dress better than you're ever going to dress for the rest of the job. And you have to perform a certain kinds of willingness to do the job above and beyond. And there's, you know, one of the things I find very interesting is there are all these examples in contemporary job interviews, like, you know, people who interview to work, say, at an Apple store, and they are, during the job interview, they have to like do something like design a poster to sell an Apple product. Of course, they're never going to do that, because it's not like you design at a given Apple store. People are breaking out the markers and designing their own posters. All that stuff is produced from corporate, you know, advertising headquarters. And so, and there is this strange way in which the kind of commitment and dedication that's demanded, in the job interview goes above and beyond, in some sense, what the job even entails. And I do think, you know, this is something that you know, there's this classic analysis of emotional labor done by Arlie Hochschild, you know, from the 1980s in The Managed Heart, where she talks about the work of people like flight attendants, how to perform a kind of friendly, welcoming, calm demeanor, you know, to keep the air, you know, to keep the passengers happy on board the airplane. And many people have pointed out that in the time since she wrote that, around 1980, emotional labor has migrated from the front of the house, dealing just with customers, to really the back of the house, where there's an emotional labor that's done not for the customers, but it's done for the boss. You have to you have to show the boss your willingness to be dedicated. And as you know, the philosopher Paulo Virno points out, you can really see this in the mutation the word professional has undergone in the last, I don't know, 40, 50 years, from being professional as in their specific professions. Mm-hmm. Like lawyer, teacher, etc., to being, you know, professional demeanor, professional atmosphere, attitude. And, you know, and the way that the profession is defined is two things, right? It's on the one hand, it's absolute dedication, right? It's professional to stay later than you have to show up after work if you have to. But it's an absolute dedication that is also bizarrely impersonal, because it's also professional to never get, you know, angry, upset. So it's absolute dedication. It's putting your entire personality in the work, but it's a personality which is stripped of anything that makes a personality a person, really. Mm-hmm. It's this kind of weird impersonal personality. It's sort of becoming the generic figure of an employee, of like a painted on smiley face, but painting that smiley face on yourself.
Yeah, you actually mentioned that in the book. We talk about the history of the smiley face. You also discuss a movie that is a pretty dark film, in my opinion, based on a true story, Compliance. I believe we watched it here for a movie night on This Is Revolution, for one of our movie nights. Can you explain why you chose that film?
Yeah, I mean, it is a very dark film. And so, you know, it's based on not just one incident, but there are several incidents where
hundreds.
Yeah. Someone called various, they're mainly restaurants, I think. And, you know, with these claiming to be a police officer, accusing someone of an employee of theft. And this leads to the situation where the employee is subject to incredible abuse, all in some sense in the name of this a figure of authority. And I guess one of the things that I really found striking about that film is it's very easy to look at that film and, well, first of all, it's very easy to look at that film and believe that this couldn't possibly be a mm-hmm. true story. Yeah. And I think and it seems so kind of over the top and so purulent in so many ways that it seems like it's some twisted person's imagination. But even when you understand it to be a true story, you know, it has, you know, like watching it, and it is kind of a film of horror. And the same way that when we watch a horror film, we always, you know, watch a lot of horror films in that smug sort of sense that, like, I would definitely not go into the basement. Like, I wouldn't do that, right? Mm-hmm. And you can watch this film and feel very superior to it in the sense, like, you would not do those things. But I think in doing so, you miss and I think one of the things the film does really well is it shows how the compromises to one's agency, one's judgment, that of course takes on an extreme version in that film, but those compromises are built in to the experience of work for so many people. And you know, I'm really struck by, this is another sort of moment where I try to bring together Spinoza and Marx. This, you know, Spinoza has this formulation, which he considers to be kind of the basic formulation of human behavior. And it's this formulation of seeing the better and doing the worse, right? We often know what the right thing to do is, but we often do the worst. And for Spinoza, you know, that mainly has to do with the way in which we are overwhelmed by our emotions, our fears, et cetera, that compel us to do the worst, even we know we should do something better. And what I was interested in thinking about is the way in which, if we expand that out beyond the ethical scale into thinking about society and thinking about capitalism, seeing the better and doing the worse is the way in which a lot of our work lives are structured, and that we know what the right thing to do is, we know what the better is, but we know what has to be done in order to do what the corporation wants or to meet costs or whatever else the case may be.
So does our definition of the right thing then change depending of our relationship to our work? For example, the movie Compliance, for those that don't know or didn't watch it with us, I'm sure we watched it on movie night. It is a true story about a gentleman that was buying phone cards when they were a thing. I don't know if they're still a thing, and would call fast food places. I believe in real life he called McDonald's and Kentucky mm-hmm. Fried Chicken, but in the movie it's a make-believe place.
Yep.
And in real life, the woman that the movie and the subsequent lawsuit is about mm-hmm. was a manager of, I believe, a McDonald's in Kansas, and she didn't order enough something for the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie starts the way actually the woman's real day started, where the delivery driver, remember, these delivery drivers aren't like Amazon or anybody. These are corporate delivery drivers that understand need to a certain extent, right? And he reminds her, oh, you're going to get effed up for the weekend. And that becomes a real big problem, right? If you don't have enough of something, it's going to get back to your district manager. They're going to reprimand you during your quarterly review. It becomes a whole thing, right? You do things the McDonald's way. And she gets a phone call because this person did very vague things. He said he was a police officer. And he did it in cities that were just big enough where the police officer wouldn't be your uncle. Like, this isn't Ted. You know? So he calls and say he's a detective at the police place, and someone stole a purse or a wallet out of a purse. And it's a blonde employee that's working the register. And the first thing the woman did was try to figure out, well, who's a blonde employee working the register? Sees a blonde employee. And then, you know, she starts taking orders from this faceless police detective who says he's on the phone with her district manager. And he says it's a like a three-way call, which is like when you watch the movie, I've watched it a few times. And I definitely went as deep down a rabbit hole as you can go about the actual case to find out, you know, more about it. And your first reaction when you're watching it, the way you're talking about the, you know, don't go down the dark hallway, is to say, well, why wouldn't you ask to speak to this person? You know, why don't you say, just come to the off? Like, why are you calling me? All the questions you think you would ask in the moment when you're dealing in this world of compliance or get out, especially when your day already started with, you're going to get in trouble. So you're already being reduced to a child in your management position. And she's trying to take, you know, some accountability. She's trying to rein everything in at this point. Well, let me bring in this employee. And if you know anything about the movie or the real story, what happens is the person on the phone, pretty much as long as he can make her do it, makes her make the employee undress, look in her orifices for this magical wallet, and ask other people to do it. No one actually, no employees would help her do it. And then they eventually ask her to call in a friend, and she calls in her fiance, who is told to sexually assault her. And of course, there, and if you know the real story, I think both women filed lawsuits against McDonald's. The woman that kind of perpetrates this violation and the victim as well, because McDonald's was found liable because they knew that these calls were going on all over the country and they didn't want to scare anyone. So they didn't even send out any sort of warning. But when you talk about the fear in watching that movie, the first time I watched that movie, I had saw a Law and Order SVU episode with Robin Williams, where they kind of go over that same thing, which made me, you know, read into the case. So when I finally saw the film, I kind of sat back and didn't watch it from the perspective of these people are so stupid, but I watched it from the perspective of someone that's had a job working for a big corporation where there's the rules of life that make sense, but then there's the rules of the corporation that don't make sense.
Right.
Right. And it's a very unsettling film in my opinion, you know, and I saw it on a horror movie channel, you know, called Shudder, because I think it is the epitome of what is horrific in a modern context. Right. Because the fear of losing the job is, you know, being out on the street. And, you know, that you can see, I think the acting is brilliant in the movie, and you can see the wheels constantly turning in the woman's head that's kind of perpetuating all these horrible atrocities on this woman. When it hits her, it's even more kind of heartbreaking. Like, you know, why did I do all this?
Right, right. Yeah. No, I think that's a great way of putting it. And I think as you mentioned it, I think it's really important that there's a certain sense in which the film begins with a kind of infantilizing, like, you're in trouble, right? And to be a manager at such a corporation is far from being a kind of figure of autonomy or even a figure of respect. I mean, they even mentioned in the film that they're expecting a secret shopper to come in, right? So she's subject to surveillance as well. And there's a sense in which, you know, I mean, I said earlier this idea of seeing the better and doing the worse, but at a certain point, you don't even see the better anymore. Mm-hmm. And you become so accustomed to doing what you're told to do or doing what has to be done and not questioning the why it has to be done, that there is a certain way in which it doesn't seem that absurd to go along. I mean, in some sense, the policeman on the end of the line is just sort of a more stark, more in-person version of a whole set of imperatives demanding that you do what needs to be done without asking why or for what purpose. And the more you become sort of habituated to that, the more that it appears to you as the only thing that that makes sense to do. I mean, there's, you know, this, you know, one of the things that I think is really useful for once again, thinking about Spinoza and Marx together is I think both of them really understood the way in which habits, I mean, to put it in Marx's terms, you know, life determines consciousness. And, you know, Marx also says at one point, you know, the whole point of capitalism is to develop a working class who treats its requirements as self-evident natural laws. And in a similar way, Spinoza talks, especially when he's talking about theocracies and the way theocracies as forms of political power don't just rule you in terms of telling you what you can and cannot do in the political realm. They also tell you what you can and cannot eat, what you can and cannot wear, how, as Spinoza puts it, to someone so habituated to that kind of way of living, at a certain point, obedience begins to feel like freedom. And I think that one of the interesting things about compliance is it really underscores the way in which the structures and experience of contemporary work in the infantilizing sort of imperatives and rules and judgments, in the persistence of a kind of surveillance which makes you feel at any moment you could be subject to being seen or being evaluated, and the rules which, you know, you shouldn't question because there's no real point in questioning them. You just, someone says you have to do X, you do X. All those things aren't really that distinct from the world of this sadistic person who is really opportunistically sort of maximizing this terrain of fear, obedience, and, as the title of the movie says, compliance, in order to produce different perverse effects from it. But you couldn't produce those perverse effects if the conditions weren't all already there.
Well, Jason, we're coming up on the hour, and I don't want to hold you. I know it's later where you are.
It is.
In the Northeast. I do want to thank you once again. I would love to, if not continue this conversation, have you join us for a movie night or something if you're ever free. We do watch some fun movies. I do have to ask you. I don't know if we're around the same age. I'm 46.
I'm a little older.
Okay. You have what looks like a ninja sword behind you.
I do, yes.
Do you like ninja movies?
I do, yes.
Okay. That's all I need to know. You're a good man. We did a whole show on ninja movies and the history of ninja movies that went like 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
So, whenever you want to talk ninjas.
All right. Definitely.
Especially the canon film.
Oh, yeah.
Of ninja movies.
Yeah, Shokusuji. Yeah, he's the man. Yeah.
Okay, see, you're already saying the right words. You're already saying the right words. We do have a couple more super chats I want to address. Thank you very much, Ken. I work 2 months overtime and 7 weeks for free, and yet I feel guilty if I take an hour for myself during the week. I hate me. Oh, that's a rough one. That's a rough one, Ken. Know the feeling. I know the feeling. We have another super chat. There's some ninja jokes on here. You can't make me feel bad, people, about loving ninja movies. You can love ninja movies as much as me, but you cannot love them more than me. Just remember that. Look, Jason, thank you again for taking your time to talk with me. Wherever you guys are watching or listening to the show, there are links in the description to purchase Jason's book from Verso. Double Shift, The Politics of Work. Spinoza and Marx and the Politics of Work. Yeah. Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have a very good night.
You too.
I hope you unwind with a couple episodes of The Office and Ninja 3, The Domination. What better way to go to sleep than watching The Exorcist, Poltergeist, Flashdance, and a ninja movie. And
listen to all together. All right.
Have a good night, brother.
You too. Bye-bye.
So that was fun. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Wherever you are watching this show, we are going into the champagne room, and that is for patrons only. And if you would like access to that champagne room, well, it's easy. Become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. You can have access to champagne rooms past and present. Join us for our upcoming movie night this Friday, where we'll be watching the documentary Let It Fall, Los Angeles from 1982 to 1992. Talks about the LA riots, a very in-depth movie about more than just Rodney King, and an important movie as the anniversary of the riots sadly is coming up. Maybe a time for us to reflect on 68, 92, and even 2020 and ask the question, where are we now? Also, Dizzle says, how dare I not ask about the hose? Dizzle, I was going to ask him about the hose. I don't feel comfortable all the time asking people about the hose. I think I went too far when we had Dr. Jack Rasmus on. And maybe I shouldn't press my luck all the time. That being said, I will see you guys. If you're a patron, the link's already up. If you want to listen to the Champagne Room and you're listening on Apple, just sign up, become a member, and bam, you have access to Champagne Rooms past and present. And on that note, I am out.